Welcome to the High Velocity Radio Show, brought to you by the Desai Group. The Desai Group, getting the real work of innovation done. Visit them on the web at desai.com, D-E-S-A-I.com. The High Velocity Radio Show is where we celebrate innovative professionals producing better results in less time. Produced and directed by Lee Cantor and brought to you live from the Radio X studio in Atlanta, Georgia. Now here's your host, Stone Payton.
Welcome to the show, everybody. This is Stone Payton, your host for the High Velocity Radio Show. Joining me in the studio is our producer and my co-host, Lee Cantor. Good morning, Lee.
Good morning, Stone. How are you doing this fine, fine day?
Hey, it's going to be a great day. We're going to have a lot of fun today. What'd you do this week?
This week, a lot of visitors from out of town.
Oh, yeah?
I had a friend of mine, Lisa Lillian, who's the author of the Hungry Girl books, and she was in town Friday, so we took her out. She had a book signing at Borders.
That's the Sheila, right, from Australia?
No, this is someone else, actually. She's from L.A., and she came in. Her book's probably top five New York Times bestseller, just
wow,
initial release. Yeah, yeah, so it was exciting.
You're getting to be a real rock star in this
media
world,
aren't you? I'm a micro celebrity. That's my claim.
Well, we've got a terrific show for you this morning. On the High Velocity Radio Show this morning, we have a gentleman by the name of Skip Davis. He's vice president with a company called Nine Sigma, and they are a leader in helping companies implement open innovation programs. And I'd like you to please welcome to the show Skip Davis. Welcome to the show, Skip.
Thank you very much, Stone. I very much appreciate the opportunity to be on this morning.
Hey, we are delighted to have you. I tell you what would probably be helpful for our listeners and would certainly be helpful for me. Could you just give us a little bit of a primer, understanding of what open innovation really is?
Sure. Open innovation was a term that was coined by a gentleman named Henry Chesbrough. That's now he's on the faculty out at Cal Berkeley. But the idea being that companies in the past, when they were doing research and development, new product development work, would typically do everything inside their own company. You know, it was pretty much, I've got all the smart people, they all work for me, I need to guard what I'm developing, I don't want to let anybody know what's going on until I actually put a product out in the market. Open innovation is kind of a radically different approach to innovation and new product development. It's really being able to reach outside of the company very broadly, literally anywhere in the world, to source new innovation and bring it back to the company and then take products to market. So you get products to market faster, you source new innovation, new ideas, new breakthroughs, things like that. Procter & Gamble with their Connect and Develop program is probably one of the leaders in this space today.
Well, it certainly sounds radical to me. How does Nine Sigma get involved?
Well, what we do is we really work with clients in a couple of different ways. If a client is getting ready to embark on open innovation, we can work with them around organizational design, what kind of processes they need to put in place within their company, what their people's roles and responsibilities are, you know, all the front-end work that it takes to make change in a company stick and really, really be effective. The other thing we can do is more tactical, where we actually work with our clients on specific projects to connect them to the global innovation community. And by global innovation community, I mean it could be a large company like a Dow Chemical. It could be four guys in a garage out of Singapore that have some really interesting technology, that kind of thing.
And do you find, Skip, that some industry sectors are embracing this idea of open innovation more than others?
Yeah, our experience has been that people in consumer packaged goods, the P&Gs, the Unilevers, the Cloroxes, that was probably a very early adopter of open innovation. Some of the, how would I say it, more mainline, older kinds of companies like aerospace, you know, the Northrops, the Lockheeds, people like that have probably been a little bit more of the laggards in this. The other thing that's it's pretty interesting is we've just done a benchmarking survey that we completed in December and January that also showed some differences between the large companies, again, the Procter & Gamble's, the Unilevers, versus maybe the people that are more in the $500 million to $1 billion range, that there's a difference in adoption there, too, that the bigger companies were more the early adopters than some of the smaller ones.
What is the fear of the laggards for not adopting the open innovation?
Well, Lee, I think a lot of it's, you know, kind of comes back to company culture. You know, if you think about the way R&D and technology product development's always been done in the past, it's historically been done in a lab. You know, if you think back to Lockheed and the Skunk Works and things like that, you kind of have this picture of some guys working in a room, you slide pizza under the door, and, you know, 6 months later a product pops out. But, you know, so to suddenly go to that company and say, you know, you really ought to connect with somebody in South Africa that's got something really interesting because it's going to help you get to market faster. Well, people can understand get to market faster, but they still have a hard time with, you mean I have to share what I know with a guy in South Africa? Boy, I don't know if I really want to do that. So really what we see is it's culture more than anything that's probably the biggest barrier to companies adopting this stuff.
How do you help them get past that fear of the trust and the transparency it takes to really thrive in this open innovation setting?
Well, I think a couple of things. You know, in the early phases, before they've really even made the decision, you know, it's coming back to them with some case studies from other industries and you know, kind of getting them to see where other companies have realized the benefit, but then there's nothing like actually doing it. So we'll go in a lot of times and we'll run a pilot program where we may do a few projects, kind of let them stick their toe in the open innovation space. And then, you know, if you can bring back some interesting results, then people start seeing the success, and then you've got kind of the classic snowball going down the hill that they see the advantage, and then they'll start embracing it and start just adopting it more aggressively.
Now, when they adopt this kind of open innovation in the open innovation setting, who gets the money?
And help me with what you mean by who gets the money, Lee.
Like, say we're doing this in concert with that group in South Africa. Like, how is it monetized and how...
Okay. Well, the way it's monetized is, let's say that you're coming to market with a new food product and you need some kind of interesting packaging material that you don't think exists today somewhere in the world. So you might go out and see if some, you know, you might go to some of your suppliers, but you might also go very broadly across the world to see if someone has some kind of unique packaging that's really going to make your product stand out on the shelf. Well, if you find somebody that you've never worked with, basically what you're going to do is you're going to evaluate them, assess what they have, and then if what they have looks like it's going to really enable your product to be successful, then you'll, you know, bring them under contract to either buy material. You may have to give them some money up front to develop the material. So the transaction is really between the company that's doing the product development and with an alliance partner that may be developing a piece of the product. Then obviously, if you can bring something that somebody's already created or is farther along on than you are into your company, you're going to get to the market faster, which a lot of times translates in the first mover advantage. So you're probably going to get a bump in revenues and maybe dominate a market space because you were able to get there quicker.
You mentioned a term a moment ago, Skip, that's always on everybody's mind, and particularly in the C-suite, and that is results. How are these organizations really measuring ROI on these efforts?
Well, I think it to some extent, Stone, it depends where they are in their program. You know, if you look at a Procter & Gamble that's been doing this for a number of years now, you know, they're looking at top-line impact, or if it's a cost, you know, if it's an open innovation program that's focused on reducing costs to improve profitability, you know, they're able to look at that at that level now. But, you know, if you're a new company that's really just embarking on this and it's, you know, say 18 months to 24 months before a product actually hits the shelves that you can start measuring the revenue impact, you know, a lot of times what the early the companies in the early stages are doing is they're looking more at portfolio impact. You know, I've reached outside. Do I have new ideas coming into my product portfolio that may get to market in 12 months or 18 months or something like that? You know, they may also be looking at, you know, what's the decision making. You know, what's happening to decisions I'm making. So I've got this internal knowledge that a team has gained, you know, through their normal internal efforts. They've now looked outside. They've brought some knowledge in from the external community. So if you combine that external knowledge with what you know inside, you're going to make better decisions. So you may actually say, let's accelerate this internal project based on what we've seen outside. It looks like we clearly have a lead in this space. So let's throw more money, more people at it, and see if we can't get to market faster. So yeah. It kind of depends where you're at in adopting open innovation in terms of what you're measuring.
So if I'm thinking about it, it's a good idea to contract with Nine Sigma to help me through the process?
Always.
Can you walk us through some of the key stages in the Nine Sigma process?
Well, we come at it from a pretty straightforward process perspective. The first step is really what we call needs identification or needs. You know, within the company, there are a lot of ideas floating around, a lot of different product concepts, that kind of thing. It's really working with our clients to identify those, prioritize those, and then determine which ones may be the best candidates to take outside through an open innovation process. Because, you know, if you think about this, Stone, we're taking these out into the global community. So if you have something that you think is the absolute next big breakthrough, you may not want to take that concept outside due to competitive issues. Mm-hmm. But you may take pieces of it, you know, that like the packaging example, you could take the packaging piece outside without tipping off your competitor to what the end product is that's going to be on the shelf. So the very first step in the process is what we call needs. The second step in the process is what we call connect, which is basically just connecting with the external or the global innovation community. So it's how do I really get my need out broadly in the global innovation community so that I can get responses back that may bring a solution back to me. And then the back two steps in the process are to really assess what comes back. Does it fit my budget? Does it fit my timing? Are the deliverables right? You know, is this someone that I can really have a long-term business relationship with? You know, is their culture compatible with my culture? Do they have a pipeline of innovation? So it's all of that. And then the last step is the acquire, which is really to build the alliance with someone you found in the global community that's going to hopefully advance your product to market. Well, so it's needs, connect, assess, acquire.
Well, and I suspect that some of these alliances will outlive this initial project, yes?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's interesting. We've seen companies that have, you know, reached out in an initial program, found a partner somewhere, and then once they really understand what that partner's capabilities are, that could really then become a long-term alliance, especially if that alliance partner has an innovation pipeline of their own innovation that our client can continue to capitalize on as they move forward.
And so this is a trend, do you think, that's going to continue to grow and expand and plenty of opportunity for Nine Sigma going forward?
Yeah, we in this benchmarking survey that we did at the end of last year, one of the trends that we saw was that companies said that within the next five, and I don't have the report in front of me, but the trend was is that over the next 5 years, the value of external partnerships is going to dramatically increase. I think companies are realizing that it's harder and harder to go it alone in this day and age, and that there are just a whole lot of smart people around the world that they can tap into for new innovation. So this report that we did really shows the increasing importance of external partnerships over the next 5 years.
Now, regarding this kind of collaboration, is part of the value that you bring is that you're kind of vetting and making sure that the match is going to be a good love connection right off the bat rather than kind of somebody going out there kicking a lot of tires?
Yeah, we've got a methodology that we bring to our clients around that whole assessment piece that helps them whittle down the responses to who do I really want to build a partnership with going forward. So, yeah, that's one of the things that Nine Sigma definitely brings to the party.
And I'm sure you call it the love connection methodology.
That's what I call it.
Hadn't thought of that one.
I thought Chuck Woolery was on your board. That's why I brought it up.
Yeah, I'll have to go Google that one to see if there's a service mark on it.
You've made reference a couple of times to some recent research that you've done, and this is research that you're going to release pretty soon, right?
Yeah, we did a survey. I think we had somewhere north of 100 responses to it over last December and January. We were really trying to, do a study around open innovation trends, kind of benchmark what's going on, not such an academic thing, but really, you know, from people in the trenches that are doing the stuff. And we've been going back and forth in the editing. I think we're due to release it next Monday on the 27th. It'll go up on our website.
All right. And or they could come to the highvelocityradio.com website, and we'll sell it to them, right, Lee?
That's right.
Well, we'll look forward to seeing that research, and we really will do everything in our power, Skip, to make sure that that our communities are aware of it. Just absolutely fascinated and enamored with the work that you guys are doing, and could talk to you all morning, but we don't have all morning. We're about to run out of time. A couple of things I would like to do, though, before we let you go. I want to make sure that our listeners know how to get in touch with you and access this research and get a chance to have a conversation with you guys if it makes sense for them. What's the best way for them to get in contact with you?
Well, the two preferred methods these days are they can either give me a call. My phone number is 216-470-2915, or they can get to me via email, which is Davis, D-A-V-I-S, at ninesigma.com, and it's N-I-N-E-S-I-G-M-A. And then our website is www.ninesigma.com. So pretty easy to find me. And any one of those ways is a great way to get in contact with us.
Terrific. Well, listen, Skip, before we let you go, we have a little tradition here on the High Velocity Radio Show, and we ask each guest, if they would, to share a mistake that they've made somewhere in their career, and really, more importantly, what they've learned from it. Could we get you to do that for us?
Sure. I gave it a little bit of thought before coming on the show, and I guess when I was made the transition from engineer to management consulting a few years ago and got involved in my first change management program was where I really learned the importance of factoring in what I call the emotional and political components around people's decision-making process. You know, kind of being an engineer, I had always thought that, you know, if I presented a good business case or I had something that, you know, made a lot of sense from a rational point of view, people would just fall in line and that program would succeed wildly. And I can remember the first time that I actually was trying to work with a large corporate organization to, we were doing some re-engineering and trying to reduce some cycle times. And we had all this elaborate business case and all this kind of stuff, and we were just having a hard time getting the organization to embrace this. And one of the senior consultants in our firm was basically kind enough to explain to me that, you know, you have to really look at what's the effect, you know, politically to people and what's the effect emotionally to people in terms of a change environment. It's just not a great business case to always get changed. So it was really learning to look at people from a kind of a rational decision-making point of view, an emotional decision-making point of view. You know, what's my internal appetite for risk? And then, you know, for maybe middle managers, directors, people like that, what's the politics of the change? You know, what's it going to do to me in terms of power in the organization, that kind of thing?
So those change management, change leadership dynamics really do have a substantial impact on efforts like that, don't they?
Oh, they sure do. It's just amazing.
Skip, thank you so much for joining us, and I hope you'll come back. We'd love to continue to monitor your progress and learn from your efforts out there.
Well, Stone, thank you very much again for being on the show.
All right, man. Bye-bye.
Okay, bye-bye.
Until next week, this is Stone Payton, Skip Davis, Lee Cantor, and the entire Radio X family saying we'll see you in the fast lane.